НАТО
сегодня проводит маневры и на территории южного соседа России.
Just 120 kilometers separated NATO and Russia forces this week as Georgia hosted U.S. and British troops for live fire exercises. The military maneuvers were designed to increase the ability of Georgia's armed forces to work as part of NATO's rapid response force. But the high-profile exercises also illustrated something else. Even as Georgia's armed forces become increasingly interoperable with the Western alliance, the door to NATO membership, while theoretically open, remains effectively closed. And to the north, Moscow is biding its time as it seeks to reassert its dominance over Tbilisi one way or the other. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me from London is James Nixie, head of the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House, and an expert on Moscow's relations with former Soviet states. Welcome to the podcast, James. I'm glad we could finally get you on.
Thank you very much, Brian.
And also joining us from Tbilisi is political analyst Gia Nodia, a professor at Ilya State University. Welcome to the podcast, Gia.
Hello, Brian.
Hello. So it's been 8 years since NATO didn't give Georgia a membership action plan at the alliance's Bucharest summit, although at that summit it did give it a promise of eventual membership. And 2 months from now, when NATO heads of state meet in Warsaw, Georgia will still be on the outside looking in. James, I know the politics are obviously complicated. You need to get 28 member states to agree to admit a new member. But on the other hand, Georgia's probably the most prepared of any NATO aspirant in history. How can NATO square this circle? Can NATO square this circle? Or is Georgia doomed to remain in security limbo forever?
Yeah, I mean, look, you summed it up very, very, very well at the start. You said theoretically, and it's theoretically the door is open. But the fact of the matter is, let's be absolutely honest here, right from the start, I'm afraid to say that the West, and NATO in particular, is playing Georgia. Georgia isn't fully interoperable. It's not done all of the reforms that it often claims it has, but it's vastly more developed than it was in 2007, shall we say, prior to the Bucharest summit that you mentioned. So the fact of the matter is that the West will use any excuse that it can possibly find in order to delay, not so much the inevitable, but to delay what it really desperately wants to be delayed because of the Russia factor, which, of course, they can't admit. So the fact of the matter is Georgia's doing the right thing. It's progressing, sometimes two steps forward, one step back, absolutely. Plenty of room for improvement. But at the end of the day, no matter how good Georgia becomes, the West backs off just that little bit more. So I'm afraid for Georgia that what Georgia needs to do, really, is to seek ways of cooperation and partnership on the basis that, in reality, there is no imminent possibility of membership with the current regime in Russia and the West as timid as it is, if you like. So I'm afraid it's true. It's I'm sorry to say, but Russia has bombed, effectively, Georgian membership off of the table.
And I don't really think NATO's being duplicitous here. I mean, I just think the politics are difficult. Because if you remember back in Bucharest, there was a sincere desire on many NATO members to give Georgia a membership action plan. I was at that summit. But all it takes is one. NATO operates by consensus. And you got to get 28 member states on board to admit
a summit as well. I agree, but I think times have changed. I mean, that summit was prior to the Georgian War. It was certainly prior to Ukraine. And the fact of the matter is that West is increasingly nervous about antagonizing the Russian bearer any further than it is right now. I'm not suggesting that the West hasn't been remarkably unified in some of the actions it's taken against Russia, not after the Georgian War, of course, when it did absolutely nothing, but after Ukraine, when there's been surprising unanimity in terms of sanctions and generally combined 28, in fact, as far as the EU is concerned, have supported the sanctions. So that's fine as far as it goes. And rhetorically, it's all perfectly reasonable and principled. But if you want to talk the meat, if you want to talk the facts, the hard facts, then I'm sorry to say that it's not just for politics. The fact of the matter is that NATO is rather desperate not to have to concede, if you like.
Gia, how does this look from Tbilisi? I mean, are there still realistic hopes for membership? And if not, what are Georgia's alternatives?
Okay, I think at least people who understand politics in general understand also that membership of NATO is not in the cards for the foreseeable future. Of course, something may change, and then it may become realistic, and we cannot predict when and how, but things being as they are, we understand that this is not the option. But it does not mean that we have to give up on cooperation with NATO and having as good cooperation and as possible. So despite, and also continue pressuring the West, if you wish, on this point, then okay, you have promised, so what's happening? Why aren't you progressing? Things like that. So not to allow NATO somehow forget
the promise it made in Bucharest.
Yeah,
essentially.
So that, you know, we have to take advantage of that promise, however theoretical it might have been. So, but what we see is that while yes, membership is not in the cards, but there are some promising developments that following the Ukraine crisis, NATO has somewhat returned to Eastern Europe in general, and also Obama administration, which had sort of forgotten about that region at all, also started to take some notice of it. And in that context, we have a NATO training center, we have these exercises, which may not mean too much, but somehow it demonstrates symbolically at least some kind of dynamics that NATO is coming closer in a way. Mm-hmm. And that that is appreciated. Of course, we can be frustrated and be unhappy, but that's not you know, the best politics we can have. We should take advantage of whatever opportunities are there.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is. I had an interesting conversation at the NATO summit in Wales with Irakli Alassania, who was the Georgian defense minister at the time. And he seemed to think that these things like these exercises and these training centers is going to be able to create a momentum that's going to kind of create this creeping membership to the point where Georgia's integrated with the NATO's command structure to such an extent in every way except the Article 5 guarantee that it's going to eventually become a fait accompli. I mean, that was Irakli's thinking at the time. Do you see that as where things are going right now still?
I think that's still the thinking. I mean, it's okay, Article 5 is in a way all that matters if we speak about hard security matters, right? So, and that commitment of Article 5 is what it is, what is intimidating NATO countries and pushing them away from kind of supporting Georgian membership. But yes, the best that we can do is to somehow integrate with NATO as much as possible without membership, and as I said, take advantage of any opportunity in that direction. We cannot predict how much will that mean. I mean, we just do what we can do at this point, and we cannot predict how NATO will develop, how NATO-Russia relations will develop. Things may change for the better from our perspective, of course, or for the worse, but we cannot predict that. So we just have to take advantage of any opportunities that come our way.
James, what do you think here? Because, I mean, I'm looking, I mean, I know pretty soon this month, I believe, the Swedish parliament, for example, and Sweden and Finland, yeah, we're not just talking about Ukraine and Georgia here in terms of NATO expanding and not expanding, but Finland and Sweden are both flirting with membership. Neither are ready to join. Yeah. The question there is the reluctance on the part of those two countries, not the reluctance on the part of NATO. But what is happening is that the Swedish parliament is going to vote on a host nation treaty with NATO this week.
Yeah.
We're talking about, you know, Sweden being almost completely integrated into the command structure, but just, again, without the Article 5 guarantee, which the Swedes don't feel they need. Is this creeping membership thing maybe a solution to this? And will it create a fait accompli?
I admire your optimism, Brian, and especially yours, Gia, and Irakli, as you say. And I I very much take a point. I think you're doing exactly the right thing, speaking to you, Geir, that I think that Georgia is quite rightly playing the ball and not the man, if you see what I'm saying, and that it's doing everything it possibly can to make itself as attractive and as interoperable and as fit for membership as it can, and giving NATO and less excuse to get out of it. Now, it is, but unfortunately for Georgia, there is there are big differences between Georgia and Sweden and Finland, in the sense that Sweden and Finland are, of course, quite obviously, not former Soviet countries, and that does make a big difference to in perceptions. I think it makes a difference in the Kremlin as well. The Kremlin has more of a feel, more of an emotional hold over Georgia than it does over Finland and Sweden, which are de facto integrated anyway, as you rightly say, Brian.
Sweden,
whereas Georgia, and to a certain
extent. To a certain extent, Finland.
Yeah, to an extent, exactly. Whereas Georgia still has domestic problems, it's still not a fully tested democracy, shall we say. It's still 20% occupied by Russia, shall we say. And I think that these factors are just make the Western countries a little bit more reticent than they are. The Western countries aren't reticent about Montenegro, as you alluded to earlier. But they're not especially not reticent about Sweden. But I think Georgia would be such a departure of the past, you know, beyond the Baltic states, because that's again added. Because of what happened to the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact back after the war, then I think the Baltic states were an exception as well. But there's not many more exceptions on the map.
Yeah.
Now, when you start talking Ukraine and Georgia, then you are in a whole different ballgame. Not for you and I, but right. As far as the Kremlin is concerned.
Now, at a conference in Kyiv, Sandy Vershbaugh, the Deputy Secretary General of NATO, floated this very intriguing idea that's been getting a little bit of press: this so-called 28+2. Formula,
yeah.
the formula to give Georgia and Ukraine so-called association partnerships, which would basically integrate them into the command structure, in again every way but Article 5. Gia, again, this is either of you actually, whoever wants to jump in on this. How do you think will this satisfy the Georgians? And we're not talking about the Ukrainians as much today. And how do you think that'll play in the Kremlin? I mean, because again, it's anything that draws Georgia closer to NATO makes the Kremlin hyperventilate. And actually, on Finland and Sweden, I mean, if you look at some of the rhetoric coming out of the foreign ministry over the past couple of weeks about that, they do seem very concerned about that. I mean, Finland, of course, shares a 1,340 kilometer border with Russia and has historically had warm ties. But on the 28+2, what do you think? How do you think that would fly?
Okay, I think from Georgian perspective, it's a great idea, provided we understand that membership is not realistic option for this moment. So I think what Georgians want really to feel that there is some movement, some progress, that there is no full stagnation. So this formula sounds like there is something tangible in the sense of progress. As to Russian reaction, okay, Russian reaction was very bad also to these exercises that were here a couple of days ago. So Russian reaction will always be negative. I mean, what matters is what kind of reaction it will be beyond words and beyond statements. So I think that's the main question. And I don't think that such kind of thing, if it happens, such this 28+2 formula, there is always risk, some kind of risk everywhere. But for me, it's hard to imagine that it will be an excuse for Russia to take military action, let's say so. For military action, vulnerabilities of Georgia are not as strong anymore. Okay, we have... there is now, anyway, there is a scheduled referendum in South Ossetia on kind of South Ossetia going Crimea way and being actually annexed by Russia. I don't think it was a response to something, or maybe it was, I don't know, in terms of Georgian moves, but it may happen anyway. So it will be very unpleasant for Georgia, of course, but that territory is effectively lost for the time being. So what kind of legal status vis-a-vis Russia it will have it does not change facts on the ground, let's say so.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these kind of reactions from Russia are unpleasant and bad, but they don't make real changes, let's say. For Georgia, we are still there. So
the 28 plus 2
is... I think it's a problem of Russian reaction is more a problem for the West, for NATO countries, rather than for Georgia.
Uh-huh. James, what are your thoughts on this, the 28 plus 2?
Yeah, I think that 28 plus 2 is not that different to MAP. Whatever you call it, whether you call it a membership action plan, whether you call it 28 plus 2, it's one more digressionary step on the way to avoiding membership, full membership. So it's like exits on a motorway. When you have exit 8 and you have exit 9, you want to build another exit in between. You can keep on building exits in between, but you'll never quite get to your destination. And it seems to me that the West is doing everything that it possibly can to avoid the difficulty. And that is because, at the end of the day, whatever techniques, whatever architecture, instruments we use to bring Georgia and NATO closer together, we're not solving the fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem, as you have alluded to, is that Russia will not brook any cooperation, really, between NATO and what it sees as one of its children. And the fact is that there is an impasse here, and we are desperately trying to avoid the impasse through clever techniques. But if we want to solve a problem, actually, we're going to have to solve Russia. And actually, that's not really possible under the current regime. So I'm sorry to sound pessimistic, because I admire, as I say, Gier's optimism and the fact that you're trying so very hard to put a brave face on it when actually the West is trying so very hard not to accommodate, really. And as I say, you're doing exactly the right thing, but we're not solving the fundamental problem here because we can't.
Gia, what do you think? Are you putting a brave face on an impossible situation?
I don't think it's about optimism. It's maybe about not having any other option. I think there is no other security arrangement which is acceptable for Georgia. So we have to make the best of what options we have. And although, of course, we cannot feel ourselves secure, but... Okay, it depends what standard of security you expect. And we are not as secure as Switzerland, obviously, but save for this interruption of 2008 and having lost territories, most of which we have lost actually in early 1990s, Georgia has chances to develop. It has been an independent country for 25 years. It is generally free to choose its international friends, and that's something to appreciate and something to defend, if you wish. So NATO membership is a best-case scenario, but when we don't have best-case scenario, we have to do as much as possible. After Bucharest summit, we changed somewhat our priorities towards European Union and European Association Agreement and things like that. So that also does not give any guarantee.
Which is equally unacceptable to Russia, actually.
Yes. But and it is also unacceptable to Russia, but it's happening, nevertheless. So it is still, it means that, we expect visa-free regime, we expect that there will be economic interoperability, if you wish to, if you want, I can say so, with Europe, and that also bring Georgia somehow closer to Europe in this case. So wherever there is a small chance, we take advantage of that. Now, it's just realism. I would not call it optimism necessarily.
James, Gia makes a good point here, because actually you had a piece a couple of years ago called The Long Goodbye, which basically talked about how Russia was slowly but surely and steadily losing its influence in the Caucasus. So let's flip this on its head. I mean, regardless of what happens here, isn't Georgia moving in one direction and one direction only, and in that direction is a one-way street, regardless of NATO membership?
It's a one-way street, but it's a very, very long street. And the fact of the matter is that Russia has changed the nature of the game somewhat, but it has, through military force, it has caused the West to give pause. And I'm sorry to say this, but the West let down Georgia so badly in 2008, It was a 5-point plan, and Russia ignored each of those points, and it was forced into.
You mean the Sarkozy ceasefire?
Sarkozy ceasefire, precisely. It made Sarkozy look very foolish indeed. But that's just one European leader, who soon went. The fact is that Ukraine did change things a little bit. It forced the Europeans into some kind of collective action, but. I think there is a yes, you're right. The countries themselves of the former Soviet Union, if you'll forgive the phrase, definitely there is an inexorable movement towards the West, from each of them, to be perfectly honest with you. Even Turkmenistan has a multi-vectored foreign policy, let alone Georgia. The fact that Russia has inserted itself into the game by making its approach more muscular, more aggressive, and the West, I'm sorry to say, has not fully taken that into account, and it hasn't fully understood that, you know, how important it is to Russia. That's not to justify it, but I don't think the West has fully understood that Russia is prepared to go to further and more extreme lengths than the West is to retain Georgia, than the West is to bring it in. The stakes are higher for Russia in a way.
No, yeah, basically Russia definitely has escalation dominance on this battlefield, that's to be sure. And that's a good way to segue into something else I wanted to talk about. It's like things that Georgia can do short of NATO membership on its own to enhance its security. Whatever happened to Guam, for example? Gia, what about Guam? Is it? I know it still exists on paper, but is that the only place it exists?
Guam, I have not heard of Guam much.
Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, Azerbaijan.
I know.
Not for you, for our listeners.
Uzbekistan sort of joined it and then withdrew. Yeah, but there were several other kind of regional initiatives. There was Community of Democratic Choice, CDC, which was promoted by Saakashvili and Yushchenko in their times, and there was talk of Baltic Sea, Black Sea axis. So, yes, there are such projects, and I think it makes lots of sense to have some kind of regional solidarity and regional cooperation outside of NATO, even though with some kind of NATO or European Union support. But so far, none of those initiatives really materialized into something serious. I think for that there is a need of two things. One is a serious sponsorship by the West, by United States or NATO or European Union. Somebody has to help those or such kind of partnerships. Yeah. And on the other hand, of course, you need quite strong commitment within the countries. Mm. So when there was this kind of Saakashvili-Yushchenko axis, one can say so, two active politicians, they tried also to create something regional. They did not succeed in terms of anything kind of formidable being created, but at least there was some kind of movement. Now, we don't have this kind of leadership within the region. In Georgia continues its movement, both in terms of relations with NATO and European Union, but it also tries to appease Russia, so it is very careful not to be seen as too close to Ukraine leadership. Of course, there are some specific other reasons of Saakashvili's presence in Ukraine and things like that, but even without that, I think it is more about appeasing Russia so that Georgia has distanced itself from Ukraine rather than
the current Georgian government has.
Yeah, yes. I mean current post-Saakashvili government of Georgia. Yeah. Now, if government changes in Georgia in October, which may or may not happen, we don't know how that will affect this kind of activity. But current Georgian government is very passive in terms of trying to design or develop some kind of regional partnerships. Mm.
Now, there was a recently a very interesting piece by Andreas Umland, my good friend and frequent guest on this podcast for the European Council on Foreign Relations, about reviving the so-called intermarium, this idea of an ad hoc collective security pact of countries in Central and Eastern Europe that would, outside of the framework of NATO, pledged to defend each other in the event of outside aggression from Russia. So this wouldn't be something that would have to be sponsored from the outside, but something that would come from within. It would basically be a collective security pact. What were your thoughts on that? And is that something like that possible? I know it was a very clever piece that Andreas wrote. It certainly got me thinking quite a bit. But is such a thing, looking at it from Tbilisi, is it realistic?
Yes, as an idea, it's wonderful. I think it's kind of revival, what I mentioned, this Baltic Sea, Black Sea axis. Yeah. I think it's a very similar idea in a way. But it requires first strong sponsorship from the West, but also some kind of driving forces also in the region. But I don't see this kind of momentum yet for this kind of thing.
But everybody seems to have their eggs in the NATO basket.
I think it's good to discuss, but again, I'm afraid that some kind of nudge may have to come from the outside. I don't know, maybe Polish leadership takes some initiative. I don't know. They have this kind of elan in that way. But unfortunately, in Georgia, I don't see kind of real willpower to advance such things.
James, what are your thoughts on these kind of ad hoc, or either the revival of Guam or the Intermarium, these kind of ad hoc security alliances? What are your thoughts there?
There are so many, aren't there? There's Eurosec, there's all sorts of Russian-led initiatives, there's Western initiatives, initiatives in the region itself. And when the history of, you know, how the post-Soviet states migrated towards the West comes to be written, then I think we'll have quite a fun time in cataloguing all of these different initiatives, treaties, stepping stones, collective organizations and groupings. I think they do indeed all add in a little way towards the inevitability of these countries' full independence. If you, he has said that Georgia is broadly free to choose its own sort of foreign policy direction. I would say that's broadly true, but clearly there are limits and constraints on everything that Georgia would like to do compared to the reality of what is happening. But if you take the view that it is indeed sort of inexorable and that Russia is like King Canute pushing against the tide and it's just not possible, then I think the West is very inventive, and the countries themselves are very inventive because they're so proud of their independence at developing techniques. And we're facing this one really big obstacle, which at the moment looks rather insurmountable. But if you take the longer view, it's been 25 years, as you mentioned, and I'm sure that in 25 years from now, then we will see something substantially different, rather than these sort of incremental techniques and this incremental architecture which we witness on a day-to-day basis.
Well, who's the optimist now? That's on that optimistic note. It's a good time to shift gears. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and look at how Russia is trying to capitalize on the West's reluctance to embrace Georgia and the disillusionment it is causing. I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is James Nixie, head of the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House and an expert in Moscow's relations with former Soviet states. And joining us via Skype from Tbilisi is political analyst Gia Nodia, a professor at Ilya State University. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Europe is a home for Georgia. We see Europe as a space which provides certain standards of democracy, human rights protection, and this is what Georgian people aim to achieve. We don't want Europe or NATO to be against somebody. We have 25% of Georgia occupied by Russia, and despite that, we need to show our willingness to constructively resolve the conflict that we have.
And that, of course, was Georgian Prime Minister Georgi Kvirikashvili speaking to CNN in a recent interview. Well, a strong majority of Georgians certainly want to join Europe, but it doesn't appear to most Georgians that Europe is returning the love, as we discussed throughout most of the first half here. EU membership remains a distant prospect. NATO membership appears, at least in practical terms, to be off the table for the moment. And as Georgia becomes increasingly disillusioned with the West, possibly, Russia is beginning to move in to fill the void. Moscow has forged alliances with ultra-conservatives, poured money into pro-Russian media and NGOs, stressed the common link of Orthodox Christianity, and denounced the West as a temple of decadence. And to top it all off, elections are coming up in October. Gia, given this environment, how much longer will Georgians remain pro-Western? Can the West take this for granted?
Okay, I think things have changed in Georgia in the last years. I would say since 2009, gradually, since 2008 war, that while open support of pro-Russian direction in politics or anti-Western, which is by default pro-Russian in Georgian case, has ceased to be a taboo. So earlier, all mainstream parties were looking in the same direction in that sense, even though they were fighting each other very fiercely. But now we don't have that. Now we have openly pro-Russian, openly pro-Western discourse kind of legitimized. But despite that, and there were a lot of fears in Georgian society, among Georgians like me, who like Georgia to be a European country, maybe Russia is gaining too much ground by these activities. And it has gained some ground, yes. There are some Georgian organizations who are not only parties, but also NGOs or news organizations, which basically share this Russian message box, if you wish, and translate it into some kind of Georgian version of it. But still, we see in polls, at least, we see that majority and strong majority of Georgians still support both EU and NATO membership. And in October, we'll probably, for the first time, we'll have an openly anti-Western party in parliament. But there are such parties, obviously, also in Europe, in their parliaments. But still, majority will continue to support pro-Western line, and that will be kind of will continue to be mainstream. Mm-hmm. Let's say so. So we don't know whether the Russian influence have peaked already or it's going to go deeper. It's hard to say, but I would not rule out that it has already peaked. Mm-hmm. I think it peaked, especially after Ukraine, when Russia made such gains in Ukraine and looked, and the West looked so weak and confused. So people somehow started to have doubts that maybe it's Russia's momentum now, and Russia is gaining strength, is going from strength to strength, and the West has nothing to respond. And I think that influenced the Georgian public opinion as well. But I think in the recent year or so, we have some kind of new balance, if you wish, in those relations that Russia, yes, Russia gained something, but not that much after all.
And it also lost quite a bit.
It also lost. And the West, yes, it looks indecisive, inconsistent, etc., but it's still, you know, it can do something and can somehow make real problems for Russia and for Putin. So in that sense, I think the last few years, I think that peak of disillusionment with the West may have passed in Georgia for this moment. We don't know what will happen in the coming years.
Even as the West, even as NATO membership keeps getting put off and put off and put off, and as the kind of joining Europe becomes, just seems increasingly distant, even given that, the pro-Western sentiment will remain, you think?
For the time being, it will. Yeah, I don't know what happens in 10 years' time or something like that, but for the coming years, I hope, and it appears that it will.
James, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a genuine risk of disillusionment amongst the Georgian populace and the Georgian politicians, while the West continues its, I don't know, subtle dance, or while the West continues to be not especially forward with or reluctant to take Georgia on. But at the same time, there's a competing factors here, because it's very hard to see a situation whereby Russia, as an alternative model, becomes more attractive to Georgia than the West. Yeah, I mean, even though the West has done spectacularly badly of late with its turn to the right, with its economic implosion, with its policies towards the South Caucasus, which have been disinterested and half-hearted, then I still think that the West is looked upon in Georgia, with the possible exception of, by, if you like, the really religious section of Georgia, shall we say, that section commanded by the Georgian Patriarch and Georgian Orthodoxy proper. But by and large, the West is still seen as a place of prosperity and something to aspire to. And it's very hard to see the Russian model supplementing or surpassing that in any way. So I agree that the disillusionment is absolutely a risk, and I think that the West has played it badly, and there's a potential for it to play it worse. But again, you're right. I mean, as you said at the end of the first half, I think there is room for optimism based upon ultimately the West's superior, if not perfect, model.
Mm-hmm. The superiority of Western soft power here is going to eventually trump Russian hard power.
It's a Russian hard power, but as a model, as an economic model, in terms of standard of living, in terms of democracy, then it's very hard to see at the moment Georgia, which is still, if you like, crazily enough, it's still relatively fresh from the Rose Revolution. It still means something. And that sort of optimism, that enthusiasm, that inspiration hasn't entirely died. That is because of the Georgian people themselves, and if you like, an intrinsic, I do think that is an intrinsic Europeanness to Georgia. And you only have to go to Tbilisi, and you have to travel to Georgia itself to realize that actually it's one of the least Soviet of former Soviet states.
Yeah, it certainly is. And as I was listening to you, James, I couldn't help but recall a very eloquent comment your colleague at Chatham House, James Scher, made about it, where he said, "We're not in a new Cold War, but we do have two normative systems developing on the Eurasian landmass, one to the west, based on the rule of law, the sanctity of contracts, the individual rights, and one to the east, based on patron-client relationships, the subversion of power, money to power, the subversion of law to power, the merger of money and power and corruption." And so any sane person is going to want, I think, is going to want the system that's based to the west in that situation.
Yeah.
Gia, now I want to return to the elections with you, because I'm actually quite curious about this. I mean, it's still early. They're still several months away. But how do you see them playing out? You noted to me when we were talking off mic, there's still 50% undecided. I mean, who are the key players? I mean, the key players are Georgian Dream, the United National Movement, Irakli Alassani is Free Democrats, and it's not clear what the Republicans are going to do, if they were going to stay in the Georgian Dream coalition or not. When I look at that configuration, I find it hard not to see a strong pro-Western majority emerging in the new parliament, no?
Okay, it depends also on how we evaluate Georgian Dream Party per se. Somehow its pro-Western credentials were initially mostly buttressed by Republicans and Free Democrats being part of the coalition, which is no longer the case. I mean, Republicans are formally in the coalition until elections, but they will run separately.
You think they're going to run separately? That was the
no. That's for sure. That's clear. What kind of animal this Georgian Dream Party is? It's still unclear. It's kind of just a club of people whom Bidzina Ivanishvili decided to write into some list, but. And it will change after election. I mean, before elections, we'll have some different list. It appears so, and different people. So whether you count it into a strongly pro-Western camp or not, I think that's important question. But otherwise, those are the players which you mentioned, but now it's augmented by a new movement led by an opera singer Mr. Pata Burjuladze, but his team so far includes mostly, let's say, so pro-Western leaning people. And in his first announcement, he said that several times that he's strongly for European Georgia, etc. And they have quite good starting rating. So they are actually better off than Alassania, a couple of percentage points ahead of Alassania. So I think there are doubts about what he really wants, because he's a total political novice. But still, I think most people believe that he will strengthen the pro-Western camp in Georgian parliament. So we cannot be sure about anything in Georgia, especially with this 50% undecided. But at least if we judge from what we have now, then Georgian Dream cannot win fair elections, let's say so. And we hope they will be fair, but we cannot be sure about that either. And we'll have some kind of really coalition government in the end. Really, I mean parties who, that coalition that will be formed on the basis of the results of parliamentary elections.
I mean, do you see Irakli Alassania's Free Democrats and David Usupashvili's Republicans working together with the United National Movement, given the history there, and there's some difficult history there?
Yes, I'm afraid that Republicans may not be able to get into parliament and get over 5% threshold. It's too crowded now, especially with this new Burjuladze's Opera Singers party, but they may. It will be difficult, yes, absolutely, it will be difficult. There is some history of personal bitterness between them, but it will be more difficult with Republicans if they do get into coalition, but I think Alassania and National Movement can get on. It's possible. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the 1,000-pound gorilla in the room, of course, is former President Saakashvili, who is not in Georgia, but his presence is very much in Georgia, no?
Okay, UNM is in its daily kind of life as a party is somewhat independent, pretty independent from Saakashvili, but for the voters, he is a brand name. It is still Saakashvili's party. So, and it's still important what he says. So we had a defection of one quite influential member of UNM, which was reputed to be close personally to Saakashvili. So there were some talks about some coming split, but in like 2 or 3 hours, Saakashvili made a statement that said that, oh, I am with the party and this is the only real force to against the government, things like that, and totally distance himself from this defector. So this is this. I said that to show that it's very important what Saakashvili says.
Mm.
So, because without that, there might have been some kind of rumors that UNM is splitting, etc., etc. So his presence is there, but it's kind of background presence. Mm.
James, your thoughts on this as we head into election season in Georgia?
Yeah, and I think the election season is crucial to test the stability of the Georgian Dream movement. I mean, it's had amazing success by democratically overturning an incumbent power party. But you need to have democracy isn't just measured in elections; it needs to be measured in some sort of longevity as well, in terms of sustainability, I suppose. And that has yet to be done before Georgia can be called a fully fledged democracy. And we've just had here in Chatham House, literally 2 hours ago, the Georgian Prime Minister, Georgi Kvirikashvili, was speaking. He is a member of the Georgian Dream Party, of course. He has approximately 50 years old. I don't know his exact age. And he has experience in business. He has experience in foreign affairs and, of course, most particularly in economics. And he is a rather more popular. The shine, as with all parties when they've been in power for a couple of years, has come off Georgian Dream slightly. And so he's been brought into this more prominent position in order to improve the party's chances prior to the elections. And obviously, he, as a typically astute, Western savvy, good English speaking Georgian politician, then he's able to very well articulate Georgia's domestic and foreign policy platforms to a Western audience. But I think also, as I say, he's popular amongst Georgians themselves as well. And so I think that is also a useful weapon on the part of the Georgian Dream Party prior to October. As far as Misha Saakashvili is concerned, then clearly this is in a way, this is something that has not necessarily done the Georgian Dream Party much credit either, because although Saakashvili remains discredited, his popularity ratings have marginally increased since he left, but the chasing of him and the persecution of him, the call for his arrest, it just rings the past. It rings of what the previous government did with the previous administration again. So it's not. So you just get the feeling sometimes that it's more about internecine, inter-party political fighting rather than moving ahead. And that has somewhat tarnished Georgian Dream, both amongst the population and in the West as well, actually.
And it's increased the popularity of the United National Movement, hasn't it, Gia?
Okay, now it has not increased very strongly, but Georgian Dream ratings has decreased quite strongly. So now there is only 1 or 2 percentage difference in favor of Georgian Dream, but still they are kind of very close to each other.
Uh-huh. And the thing to be watching is not just the horse race between these two, but where, you know, how Alassania's Free Democrats fit into the mix, how the Republicans, if they get into parliament, fit into the mix, and
yeah,
so on.
Yeah, I think there are 5 to 6 parties who have a chance to get over 5% threshold. Again, I'm not sure about Republicans, but there is also a populist Labour Party which may make it. There is this pro-Russian, openly pro-Russian Patriots Alliance Party. Burjanadze's party may or may not make it. So we'll have quite a diverse parliament. Again, I'm judging from today's ratings, today's opinion polls, but we don't know what happens in five months.
Okay, well, I mean, I guess the picture, I mean, it seems to me, if I were to make a prediction based on what I'm hearing here, is that we probably will have something, however narrow, a certainly a pro-Western majority in the new parliament, the pro-Western government.
Unless the Georgian Dream Party, for some reason, moves from pro-Western platform, which I don't think
I don't see that happen.
Kvirikashvili is a new face of the party. He's somewhat different from many people within his party, let's say so, in his pronouncements, and he's very good face for the party in the West, but I would not agree with James that he's terribly popular in Georgia. There was this expectation, I think, in Georgian Dream of so-called Kvirikashvili effect, mm-hmm. that it would boost the ratings of the party, but it had not so much, because the greatest problem of Mr. Kvirikashvili is this image, whether he is really independent player, because prime minister, but whether he can do what he believes he should do, or he should follow Mr. Ivanishvili's kind of orders. So that's a big problem for him, and so far he could not overcome this.
And this is going to be the problem for any Georgian prime minister that's a Georgian Dream prime minister. There's going to be the
absolutely
question of whether it's just
a large majority of Georgians are convinced that it's Mr. Ivanishvili who is behind the scenes and calling the shots, really. And I think they are right.
I think that's a very safe assumption. Georgians don't surprise me by being very politically savvy. Well, on that note, we shall wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been James Nixie, head of the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House and an expert on Moscow's relations with former Soviet states. And joining us from Tbilisi has been political analyst Gia Nodia, a professor at Ilya State University. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. You can also follow Pavel on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.